Beyond Barbarossa, Episode 65, An Interview with Roger Morehouse, Part 2. Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. Remember that you can get episodes early, ad-free, and now with images through Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose the level of support you're comfortable with. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Redbeard Studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin territory, also called Ottawa, Canada. Today is just 1 week after the last episode. Remember how I promised you more content? And today I'm delivering on that promise. 1 week since the release of episode 64, not two, one, here is episode 65. This is part two of the conversation with Roger Morehouse, historian and author of 7 books about the Second World War, with a focus on Germany and Eastern Europe. Specifically, our talk is about his 2014 book, The Devil's Alliance, Hitler's Pact with Stalin, 1939 to 1941. Last episode in part one, Roger and I talked about that pact, formerly called the Treaty of Non-Aggression between Germany and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, signed on 24th August 1939, but for some reason backdated to 23rd August 1939. Go figure, communists and Nazis. This agreement remained in effect, albeit with diminishing impact over time, for nearly 2 years, until 22nd June 1941 and Germany's invasion of the USSR in Operation Barbarossa, the event that this podcast goes beyond. Now, last week, Roger explained how the Nazi-Soviet pact is largely underappreciated and poorly understood in the West. According to Roger, it doesn't really fit into the easy narrative about the Second World War that's common in the English-speaking world, that's the narrative that I learned in high school. That narrative, just to give you the highlights, this is what I was taught. Germany started the Second World War when it invaded Poland on 1st September 1939. Britain and France followed by declaring war on Germany, but failed to stop the invasion. Then, Germany defeated France in May and June 1940 and left Britain alone to face the Nazis through the Battle of Britain until the USSR and the USA joined the fight. The thing is, that narrative leaves out some crucial elements. For example, that the USSR also invaded Poland in September 1939 and was Germany's ally for close to 2 years. It leaves out how the dictators divided Europe into spheres of influence, giving them oppressive, bloody domination over an entire continent. Roger also pointed out a lot of other fascinating details about the strategic alignment of Nazi Germany and the communist USSR. If you haven't heard the episode, or if your memory's a little hazy, I understand it's just after New Year's, we're all a little bit fuzzy. Go back and listen to it again. I'll wait. Okay, caught up? Great. Now, in this episode, we're going to dig deeper into how that relationship between the two tyrannies developed over the lifespan of the agreement. We're also going to look at some of the longer-term impacts, some of which we are still dealing with today, 80-plus years later. Roger also points to some interesting parallels between the USSR's behavior in 1940 and Russia's war on Ukraine today. So, let's get into it. Welcome again, Roger. So we were talking about the events during the lifespan of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, specifically the Winter War when the USSR invaded Finland. At that time, which was November 1939 to March 1940, was there any realistic idea that Britain and France could help Finland in a military way? For example, something similar to how the West now supports Ukraine?
It was in many ways a very similar case, and arguably you could see Finland almost became, you know, like a second sort of Spanish Civil War. So there were volunteers that went to Finland, for example. I mean, you know, there was lots of agitation in the West, Western capital, saying, you know, we must help Finns. You know, they're standing against tyranny and all this sort of thing, standing against Soviet oppression and so on. So there's a lot of press noise and public noise in support of the Finns. Mm-hmm. And there were people who put their money where their mouths were and actually went and fought. The problem that they had collectively was logistical. Because to actually get there, you've got to, you know, you either go across the whole of Scandinavia, which is nigh on impossible, particularly in winter, and the war happens in winter, or you take a rather perilous sail up through the Skagerrak and the Kattegat and up through the Baltic. Almost all of which is within easy range of German and then later Soviet defensive forces. So it's about the sort of there's a huge gulf there between the will and the actual ability to do anything about it. But it did become a big cause. There was a plan afoot, an Anglo-French plan called Operation Pike, winter of 39, early 40. Contingency plan initially. There are always contingency plans. They're all over the place, and a lot of them are red herrings because we find them in the archive and we go, "Oh my God, look at what they were planning to do." Well, they have contingency plans for everything, but this one was actually put into action. So this was the plan for a bombing raid on the Soviet oil fields of the Caucasus. Baku, Azerbaijan, and so on, which is the main Soviet oil fields, and they were to fly from bases in Persia, in Iran. So what sets this apart from a mere contingency plan is that they actually had the aircraft ready. They had moved aircraft into place to carry this out, right? Which makes it a little bit more than just a random contingency plan. They were planning to do this in the spring, early summer of 1940. It was all planned out. And the logic was that they viewed the Soviet Union as the sort of soft underbelly of this grand... It was described once by a British journalist as Teutoslavia, you know, this grand unit that ran from the Rhine all the way to Vladivostok, right? So they saw it almost as one entity. The raid never happened. It was, you know, events were overtaken by the German invasion of France in May 1940, so it never happened. But it's interesting to, you know, just bear that in mind, that there was some strategic thinking that viewed this as potentially a permanent thing. Viewed the Soviet Union as the soft underbelly of Hitler's Reich.
Well, that's fascinating because, I never came across any hint of that in any of the books I've read.
And what surprises me in a way is the whole story of the Winter War, which is absolutely fascinating. Like, it's such a brilliant story. This is a tiny country. Well, it's not a tiny country, but it's a country with a tiny army. It had no aircraft. It had no tanks. It had a handful of artillery pieces. And a lot of very dedicated soldiers, many of whom were actually reservists. So they'd been through sort of military training and so on, and then they're called back up. So that's what they had. And they had the terrain, which was horrific, right? Particularly in the winter, impassable kind of taiga and forests and lakes and all of this sort of thing. So they basically
like where I grew up.
Right. Well, I mean, just imagine trying to invade it with a mechanized army. I mean, it's not an easy thing. And they basically had these tremendous kind of guerrilla tactics by way of holding up the entire Soviet army, which they did for a very long time, gave it a very bloody nose. They hold out. We're actually the anniversary today. We're recording this on the 26th of November, which is the anniversary of the Mainila incident. That was the false flag operation that the Soviets mounted to have the excuse to declare war on Finland, which they did 4 days later on the 30th.
And this is all covered in two bonus episodes of Beyond Barbarossa. So
brilliant. Well done. I mean, it's great that you cover it because it's not well known, and it really deserves to be.
Yeah.
Really does.
And that's freely available to all supporters on Patreon. Sorry about interjecting the plug.
Good plug. And you know, it made me think when you had that scenario with the Russian invasion of Ukraine back in February 22. And there was that great story that went through, you know, Western news wires about a Russian armored column that was supposedly bearing down on Kyiv. And, you know, the sort of narrative in the West was, oh my God, how long can they hold out? How long will it be till they just get crushed by this column? And then the next word is that, oh, the column itself has been attacked from all sides and has been destroyed, right?
Yes.
It became like a second road of death. And I thought at the time, this is exactly what the Finns did in 1940. Exactly.
You'd think that somebody would learn.
Yeah, you'd think. Someone in the Kremlin should have learned that this is what happens.
Yeah.
But it's one of those, and for that, you know, with references like that, you just think, well, why is such a fascinating campaign? Why is it not studied? Why is it not better known? And I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier on about the Nazi-Soviet pact and how we don't understand the pact. We don't collectively understand that nearly 2-year period when the pact was, you know, the sort of guiding document of that German-Soviet relationship. And consequently, everything that happens under the aegis of that sort of falls into a memory hole.
Right.
And I think that includes the Winter War. It includes the fate of the Baltic states. You know, it just disappears from history because, oh, it doesn't fit the easy narrative, which is that, you know, we're fighting at the beginning and then the Soviets come in. Well, you know, nobody ever asked the question, well, what were the Soviets doing for 2 years? Well, the answer is they were allied to the Germans. You know?
Yes.
To a large extent, Stalin believed in the Nazi-Soviet pact in a way that Hitler didn't, right? So for Hitler, it was only ever really a temporary expedient. It strategically got him what he needed to get in 1939. Which is a free hand to deal with Poland. It got him that economic agreement, which on paper at least gave him everything he wanted, in the expectation that he was going to be blockaded by the British and the French, like they had been in the First World War, by naval blockade. So he thought, okay, so I need a supply of oil, I need a supply of grain, because those are things that, particularly oil, that he's short of. Okay, Soviets are going to give us that. So that, you know, the economics works, the strategic aspect works, and in the process of those two being foregrounded, in Hitler's mind, again, I'm kind of extrapolating, but in Hitler's mind, you can put the ideology, the demands of ideology to a second place, right? Yeah. They don't need to be worried about at this point.
Yeah. Pause
the problem is later on. Yeah. So, you know, hard facts, strategic requirements, economics take precedence. By the time you get to the end of 40, for example, is another episode we really should know better is Molotov's visit to Berlin in November 1940, right? Nobody ever talks about that in those sort of grand strategic studies of, you know, of great power politics in World War II. It never gets talked about. It really should, right? And this is basically Molotov coming to Berlin to do what is effectively a Nazi-Soviet pact redux. A reset, if you like, to use the old Obama line. That worked great. That was the logic. We divided Central Europe between us. You know, things are going great. We've got this economic relationship. Now, where are we going to go forward from this? And that's where you start to see that strategic relationship, which had actually worked quite well, even though it was seen as temporary by the Germans, is beginning to fray, right? Mm-hmm. Because the Germans are thinking to themselves, okay, our next target really is contain the British. We've done that. They're isolated on their island. Not an ideal solution, but it will do. Their next intention is to go east again, right? That's where they always had their desire to have their sort of colonial territory, if you like. And yet, for the Soviets, they're talking about Soviet gains in... They talk about the Skagerrak and the Kattegat, the Western Baltic.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about controlling that. They talk about controlling the Bosphorus. The mouth of the Black Sea.
Yeah,
and all of these things.
Russian
to the
imperial.
Yeah, exactly.
Goal. You
exactly.
Know, conquer the second Rome.
Precisely. All of this, all of the old Russian, you know, Kremlin kind of mindset targets come out again. And all of them, to the German mind of the time, are just ringing massive alarm bells. So the Germans are going, oh my God, you know, what have we got into bed with here? And they start trying to turn the Soviets south and say, well, why don't you go and invade, you know, British India? That would be good. Why don't you do that? So they're just desperately trying to deflect them.
There's only little mountains in the way.
Yeah, exactly. But see, that strategic meeting is really significant. And Molotov eventually leaves, having had no success with his reset whatsoever. And then very soon after, you've got a meeting, a very sort of, I talk about this in the book, it was the Danubian Commission. All of the powers that basically bordered onto the Danube met every year in this, what was basically a sort of about trade, and it was about, you know, dredging and all the sort of everyday stuff of being a power on the Danube. So, of course, the Germans are a Danubian power, but now also with their presence in what had been northeastern Romania, so the Soviets, and again, as a Black Sea power, so they're there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's basically a fist fight in the what had, until that point, you know, only ever been the very sort of sedate surroundings of the Danubian Commission meeting, right at the end of 1940, where the Soviet and the German representatives basically square up and start throwing punches at each other. And the actually, day after that...
Actually punching.
Supposedly, yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. Which is a wonderful image, you know. it's a bit like having a punch-up at a parish council meeting. It's the same sort of thing. But it shows you those tensions that were beginning to come to the surface, right? And the day after that commission meeting ended in such acrimony, that's when Hitler gave the order that next summer or next spring, as it was, we're going to invade the Soviet Union. So that, you know, there was contingency planning before, but that to him was the go moment, right?
Right.
So you can see that, again, ideology is coming to the fore again, because the economic, and this way you have to sort of backtrack a bit, the economics was no longer working. So the promise of all of that grain and all of that oil that they had about four economics treaties between them. Each one had greater targets for what would be delivered, and only a fraction of it was ever delivered. The Soviets were brilliant at basically turning off the taps and you know, making, you know, some tiny issue of protocol or of you know, the full stop on a particular treaty, making that the most important thing, and subsequently turning off the tap. So they frustrated the Germans hugely in that economic relationship. The Germans had sent the Soviets, I talked about, they wanted the up-to-date tech that the Germans were supposedly going to send. The Germans sent them crap, right? They sent them all the prototypes that didn't work. You know, there's a thing called the Heinkel 100, which the Germans knew didn't work. And they sold it to the Soviets and said, oh, it's a brilliant new fighter that we developed. They knew it didn't work, right? So they basically, and they kept all the good stuff hidden.
Right.
So the two of them were both negotiating in really bad faith all the way through.
Right.
So that sort of strategic relationship had run its course. The economic relationship hadn't worked out like both of them had thought it would. And in the process, the ideology comes again to the fore.
Wow. It's fascinating to think how those different opposing forces, that's economics versus ideology, seem to be striving against each other in defining the relationship between Germany and the USSR. Let's take a short break. When we come back, I want to ask you why Stalin resisted building up the forces, getting really ready in an immediate way for a war against Germany, even as the signs of a looming invasion became obvious. This episode is brought to you by the Eastern Front Trilogy, the true story of a Canadian, Maurice Bury, drafted into the Soviet Red Army in 1941, just in time to be thrown between the jaws of the USSR and Nazi Germany at the launch of the greatest land invasion in history, the monstrous war called Operation Barbarossa. In three volumes, Army of Worn Souls, Under the Nazi Heel, and Walking Out of War, the Eastern Front Trilogy is the story of the largest and deadliest side of the Second World War, seen through the eyes of a man who was there from the earliest days in 1941, through Germany's grinding occupation of Ukraine, and finally to the savage end of the war in Berlin. You can find the three individual volumes as ebooks exclusively on Amazon, or purchase a three-volume complete paperback on any online book retailer, or at your local bookstore. To learn more about the Eastern Front Trilogy, visit scottburyauthor.com. This is Beyond Barbarossa, the first and so far only English-language podcast that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. And by now, you know I'm Scott Burry, writer and narrator. This podcast's only source of funding right now is you through Patreon. So if you like this podcast, why not subscribe or follow, or whatever your preferred podcasting platform calls it? And please consider supporting it at any amount through Patreon. Visit beyondbarbarossa.ca and click on the Patreon link in the banner. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now, let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Welcome to the second half of part two of our conversation with historian Roger Moorhouse about his book, The Devil's Alliance, Hitler's Pact with Stalin, 1939 to 1941. Roger, before the break, you mentioned that the relationship between Nazi Germany and the USSR was fraying through 1940 and especially in the first half of 1941. Neither side was living up to their trade agreements, they were dealing in bad faith, and Germany was building up its military strength along its eastern border. Even so, Stalin resisted advice, even begging by Zhukov and others, to do anything that Germany could perceive as a provocation. And this included moving significant Red Army forces to the west. In your view, and I'm not asking you to be a psychiatrist, but what could he have been thinking?
Why Stalin just doesn't believe it's coming? I think he actually bought into the Nazi-Soviet pact in a way that in retrospect is kind of hard to fathom and hard to appreciate. And I think it goes back to the role that Britain in particular played in the Russian and by extension the Soviet mind, in the mind map of the your average, you know, Soviet planner in the Kremlin. And you can see it, you see it echoed today as well in a lot of what the Russians put out in terms of propaganda about Britain. They're still quite obsessed with Britain. Even though Britain is kind of a bit part player, it's really not much of a military player anymore. You know, it pains me to say, but kind of a fading force to some extent, but still seems to loom very large in the Russian imagination.
Yeah, they talk about the Anglo-Saxons, you know, as the inimical and the perfidious
and exactly, Albion. Perfidious Albion, yeah. And I think that, you know, we can see that in a lot of Soviet thinking during the war as well. Mm-hmm. So anything, any of that information that came from the West, you know, a lot of it came, even Churchill, through various channels, tried to alert the Soviets that this was happening, that they were going to be attacked. Of course, it was just dismissed out of hand as Western, you know, this perfidious propaganda to try and disrupt the relationship. Right. So nothing that the West could say to them would make them believe it was going to happen. And they believed that, you know, this was okay. It was a marriage of convenience. It got them what they wanted, which was that economics, a strategic arrangement, got them territory, a lot of the territory they'd lost in 1918 after the First World War. Yes. So it sort of ticked a lot of boxes for the Soviets, and they just couldn't really get their heads around collectively that this was all essentially a fraud and was about to collapse around their ears. Right. And crucially, and the last point I'll give you on that is that the Nazi-Soviet pact, there's a lot of evidence to show that the Nazi-Soviet pact was Stalin's baby, right? This was his idea, okay? This was his big idea. Prior to that point, he'd not really got that much involved, particularly in the minutiae of sort of foreign policy and so on. The German ambassador in Moscow, von der Schulenburg, was present for the first night of negotiations with Ribbentrop in August 39, And it was he'd been there, I think, for 5 years. He'd never seen Stalin before.
Oh.
And then for these negotiations, yeah. Stalin was in the room, right? Which says something. So Stalin sort of, you know, was, all right, we know he's hugely significant, hugely important. But to a large extent, he's sat in the background and let other people do, you know, the negotiating or the work. He was actually there in the room leading the negotiations. Molotov signed it, but it was absolutely Stalin. You can see from the transcript, it's absolutely Stalin who is, you know, doing the negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's an added element there. You could say hubris, pride, you know, this was his baby. He could not disavow it. He could not say, okay, I was wrong.
Right, right. So he had to, in a way, is this fair to say that he's fooling himself a little bit? That
I think so.
It has to, because supposedly his plan was that they'd be ready in 1942 for a war. So he's saying, yeah, we'll just hold them off and it'll last that long.
Yeah. So we'll keep them dangling with the economic promise of these treaties. I mean, they signed I think the last economic treaty was in the spring. I think it was February 41, I think it was. Very late. So he's sort of playing them along, you know, with this economic promise of jam tomorrow, which he never delivers on. He never gives it to them. But I think he imagines that, you know, these are sort of Western capitalists, that he can do this in perpetuity, and they will forever be following the jam tomorrow. And he was the great sort of puppet master.
Right.
And then he gets bitten on the backside.
Right. Yes. Yes. Focus again on the West. It's a bit of a trope that Churchill was quick to come to the USSR side after the invasion.
If Hitler invaded hell, I would make a favorable reference to the devil in the House of Commons.
That was it. Yes.
Which is a lovely line.
He was
said in private, by the way. I mean, that he did
to his secretary.
That was said in private, but it's absolute. I mean, that's absolutely the mentality, and that's how he viewed it.
Yeah. He has such a great number of great lines like that.
Yeah.
Now, were other leaders in the West as quick to make that switch?
There was a lot of thinking, I think, on a lower level, and particularly, I mean, look, Churchill was absolutely no fan of communism. He was one of the most vehement anti-communists in the Western political sphere at the time, beforehand anyway.
So
absolutely no sort of admirer of communism. He thought it was, he once described it as baboonery, which I think is such a wonderful word. I always want to try and use that word again, but I don't think I can. But baboonery, and you can imagine, I mean, to me that just brings up, you know, images of shrieking and wild mindless gesticulation. So I love that. I love that description. And of course, he'd been behind the Allied intervention at the end of the First World War, 1919, to try and, again, another of his great phrases, to try and strangle the Bolshevik baby in its crib.
Right.
Another choice image. So he gave way to nobody in sort of anti-communist, anti-Soviet sentiment. But he certainly saw that this was an opportunity in that. It took the pressure off Britain. It took the pressure off the Western powers, as such as they were, and in a sense gave Britain the breathing space that it absolutely needed. So he embraced that opportunity with both hands. And as you said, you know, if Hitler invaded hell, I'd make a favourable reference to the devil in the House of Commons. There were many people, I think, further down the sort of political food chain, if you like, that for whom the attitude was more, well, you know, here are two monstrous criminal rogue regimes fighting each other. Why don't we just let them do it?
Right.
I think that's the sort of mentality that you're fishing for there, Scott. And there are those voices, absolutely. And actually, you know, even within the sort of upper ends of, you know, the military personnel in the West, General Ironside, I think, was one of those who essentially said the same thing. But I think the feeling was, again, even the Western perceptions, intelligence perceptions and analyses of the state of the Red Army in 1941 were so negative that the expectation was that they could last, you know, maybe 3 weeks under this onslaught, which I suppose, I mean, as we said before, that, I mean, the Western intelligence could not conceive of the Nazi-Soviet pact even being signed. So, you know, you have to wonder where they're getting their information from. But the general perception was that Soviet Union was militarily weak after the purges of the 1930s, you know, the 4 out of 5 Soviet admirals had been executed. You know, what is it, 55 out of 89 generals had been executed. I mean, the figures are ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
From the purges. And it took them a long time to come back from that. And there were all sorts of voices, again, I talk about it in the book, of non-mechanized warfare. Tukhachevsky was the great, you know, the equivalent of Guderian, for example, or a Fuller in Britain, advocate of mechanized warfare, which he saw rightly as the future. There was this other voice who basically said, oh, no, you don't want to do that. We just need cavalry and we need, you know, massed ranks and all of that.
Yeah.
Like a meat grinder you'd see now in Ukraine.
Yes, that was Semyon Budyonny, you know, the general with the big mustache, the old Bolshevik through the revolution and the civil war, always a favorite of Stalin, even though he was incompetent.
And he was the one that tended to get favored, of course, because, you know, Tukhachevsky was got rid of during the purge. So those voices are getting traction. And to a Western intelligence analyst, you're going, what the hell are they doing? Right? They're not going to last 5 minutes against the Blitzkrieg.
Right.
So you can see a little bit as to how they come to that conclusion. But the general perception was the Soviets aren't going to last. So what we have to do, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, sit back and cross our arms and say, let's let these two dreadful regimes fight it out and fight each other to the death. Basically, the perception was, well, if we let the Soviet Union be defeated, then we're in a whole load of pain because they've got all of that raw materials, they've got manpower, etc., etc., right? So then you've got Lend-Lease, then you've got, you know, that economic support and alliance that becomes the Grand Alliance behind the Soviets. In the first phase, very cynically, I would say, essentially to keep them in the fight, just to make sure they stay in the fight and they survive and they take a few German lives with them on the way, you know.
Right.
It's very cynical in the outset and then subsequently becomes a little bit less cynical.
So the knowledge of the non-aggression pact after the invasion, was that maybe, you know, a resentment of that contributed to that cynicism?
In the Western capitals, you mean?
Yes.
It's very interesting. I think there was tremendous, and you can see this in the literature if you go back and look at news reports, for example, mood reports are very, very significant in this. There was tremendous sympathy for Poland.
Right.
In that period. And then, in a way, Poland sort of falls off the Allied mind map with the arrival of the Soviets. And the Soviets then, in a sense, take the role of Poland as the poor, wronged, you know, the archetypal weeping mother with baby, dead soldier kind of image in Western propaganda and in the Western mind. That became a Soviet or a Russian, by extension, weeping mother with baby, whereas for the first 2 years of the war, it was a Polish one.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think partly expresses that shift where it becomes what is initially cynical becomes a lot more, you could say, heartfelt, maybe less cynical. But I think that sympathy for Poland before that, it never really translates too much into an anti-Soviet sentiment, interestingly. So I think that the way the Soviets had dressed up what their invasion in September 39 of Poland, right? The way they dressed it up, as I mentioned earlier on, as a police operation, as a security operation, protecting the rights of Belarusians and Ukrainians, like you'd said, anything but actually call it an invasion. So actually they stopped short of calling it a war, which sounds very familiar.
Yes.
So it was the propaganda of the Soviets was really brilliant. So anything to prevent Western opinion from juxtaposing and Hitler and Stalin, juxtaposing the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany as being on the same side in this current conflict, right?
Right.
And consequently, I think this partly explains also why we have this blind spot, because we don't see the Soviets in that first 2 years as an aggressor, right? They're just sort of there. And then almost like, you know, and this is why their subsequent narrative after 41 works so well, because it's sort of coming into a void. It's not having to overturn, you know, an established narrative that says that they're the bad guys. It's working in an area where nobody has any understanding what's going on at all. So that's partly why the propaganda works so well and has been so durable. So no, there's not really much in the way of anti-Soviet sentiment in that time. It becomes much more pro-Soviet, as I said, after the horrors of that invasion.
I know I sent you a lot of questions. I think we've covered them all. So I thank you very much. But before I sign off, is there anything that you think we should, that should be mentioned or stressed more that we haven't covered in our talk?
I think it's sort of been in the subtext, I suppose, of what we've been talking about all the way through. And that's what I'd like to try and say here is to try and promote an understanding of the Soviet Union in this period as a fundamentally aggressive power,
mm-hmm.
which I don't think we collectively see. The Soviet propaganda of the time and since, and this is rolled on through Russian propaganda currently under Putin, wherever they talk about the Second World War, they talk about the Soviet people then, and in the Russian mind, that's just the Russian people. But yeah. Of course, we know it's not, right? This is why I'm always particular about saying the Soviet Union and, you know, Soviet forces and so on.
Yes, yes, me too.
And let's continue doing that, Scott, because it's very important. So there was always that revisionist element to Soviet thinking in the interwar period.
Mm-hmm.
There's the ideological driver, which you see in 1920 with the Polish-Soviet War, to expand communism. You know, this is a universalist ideology.
Right.
Which we, again, in the West collectively forget. It's a universalist ideology. It's intended to take over the entire world, because otherwise it doesn't work, right? It has to take over the entire world. So it needs to expand. So after you've consolidated in the Soviet Union, you need to expand.
Right.
So you can see how all of these drivers are making the Soviet Union, in a kind of weird way, not necessarily just the same as Nazi Germany was, but in a slightly lesser and slightly more peculiar way, still an expansionist power, still an aggressor power. And still resolutely viewed the British and the Americans and the French as, you know, imperialists, you know, dyed-in-the-wool enemies of everything the Kremlin stood for. We need to sort of stress that to ourselves and understand that that was the driver.
Right. It's
fundamentally aggressive.
Yes, and there was the war games that they had conducted, was it 1940, imagining or practicing for a German invasion, where Zhukov took the side of the Germans. And he won, which was...
Yeah, interestingly, yes. Yeah.
Again, you think, we've got to do something different here.
But I think, as I said before, I think there's an inability to really sort of visualize. It's kind of seeing through everything through that ideological prism. It makes them unable to sort of visualize the world as it is.
Right.
Which is that there's a big difference between Nazi Germany and the Allied powers, right? They're not just, you know, a homogenous... hostile outside world. Admittedly, one of them you're in an arrangement with,
right?
But that's kind of how they viewed it, and it was fundamentally sort of misleading, and sort of skewed the sort of Soviet vision. But that, if there's one thing I would say, it's just to try and remember that the Soviets, they always try and portray themselves. Even now, the Russians, the narrative is the Russians portray themselves either as victims or as victors, right?
Right.
Nothing else. Never an aggressor.
No,
and we have
they're
to
only defending ourselves.
Exactly.
NATO is getting closer.
That feeds into the whole propaganda narrative today with Ukraine. And we have to remind ourselves, both historically and now, Russia and the Soviet Union is also an aggressor state.
Okay, well, that's, I think, a really good point to end on, what the lesson of the past is for today and the future. Roger, I really want to thank you for your time. You've been very gracious in putting up with my technical inabilities and my cat, and
I love the cat.
Okay.
A great pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Before we go, tell us what's next for Roger Morehouse.
What's next? So that, as I said, Nazi Soviet Pact Devil's Alliance was 2014. I then did a book on the September campaign of 39, the invasion of Poland, joint invasion of Poland, which was called First to Fight in the UK, in the US and Canada. Yeah. It was called Poland 39.
Oh, okay.
That was a few years later. And then the latest one was called The Forgers, which is about the Holocaust and a rescue operation done by Polish diplomats. And then the current book, I've gone back to German stuff, which I'm just finishing the book at the moment. It will be out next autumn. Maybe late, maybe just into 26 in the US and Canada, which is about the U-boat war, looking at the U-boat war, but kind of from a German perspective. So what did the Germans think they were doing? What was the experience like of being on a submarine for 2 months on patrol? short answer is, yeah, exactly. It was pretty dreadful. So it's like, the short sell is, it's like Das Boot, the history book, you know, right. effectively. So trying to use a lot of German voices, use war diaries, you know, memoirs and so on, to piece all of that together. What was it like to serve as a U-boatman in World War II? So that should be out at the end of next year, beginning of the year after.
That sounds fascinating. Well, thank you again, Roger. And I'll put links in the webpage for this episode to all your books and your site, rogermoorhouse.com.
Wonderful. Thank you, Scott. Well, all the best.
Thanks again, Roger. That was Roger Moorhouse, author of The Devil's Alliance, Hitler's Pact with Stalin, 1939 to 1941. Thank you again. And I want to thank all of you listeners for tuning in to Beyond Barbarossa, still the only podcast in the world in English that focuses on the Eastern Front of the Second World War. As always, there are maps and photos on the webpage for this episode, as well as links to all of Roger's books. So just go to beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com. And if you're a Patreon supporter, you can see a full slideshow of this episode ad-free. That's at patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. And I want to take a moment just to thank all of you who are supporting the podcast through Patreon. If you like this episode, please hit the follow button. And I'd also really appreciate a rating on whatever podcasting platform you use, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever it is. Hitting either the follow or adding a review or rating triggers the algorithms to let other history buffs know that we exist. Do you have any questions or ideas, thoughts, comments to make? I'd love to hear from you. Reach me by email at contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. And you can also find me now on Blue Sky, scottthewriter.bsky.social. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Bury. I'm Scott Bury. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina i Heroyam Slava!